First they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world.
Health and biotech news, a tech bro or sis would find kind of interesting.
We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey.
On the advice of counsel, I will not be giving an opening statement.
Of the entire human genome.
Okay guys, so let's do this story on is this the death of direct-to-consumer DTC health startups? So basically, during COVID, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, put in waivers allowing these health startups to prescribe controlled drugs, things like Adderall, Ritalin, oxycodone, basically over the internet without doing an in-person consultation. And we've seen a huge boon in telehealth startups who are doing this. And some people criticize them. Big criticism for Cerebral, a telepsychiatry startup. A senior exec came out and said, look, these guys are just a pill mill. They're really over-prescribing ADHD medication to their patients. They're not doing any proper assessment, and they're just handing these out like candy. So now the DEA have proposed rules to close down this waiver, so close down this loophole. And unsurprisingly, the American Telemedicine Association are unhappy about this. And in response, the DEA have extended this waiver for about a year and a half now. But it looks like after November 11th, 2024, this waiver is going to be shut down. So both of you have started telemedicine startups. What's your read on this? Is this going to spell disaster for these kinds of companies?
So my take is that, first of all, it makes sense because what happened at Cerebral and a few other startups was kind of a bit outrageous. There's like a new wave of startups, of telehealth startups that basically are looking at single verticals of health and doing an asynchronous consultation online, and then resulting from that is a prescription and delivery of a medication. So when you look at people like Hims, Newman, who you interviewed, the CEO recently, they do things like sexual health, hair loss, and for those kind of verticals, the harm is minimum. But when it gets into a dodgy area is when it goes when it comes to things like Adderall, opiate medications. That's where a lot of people will try to scam the system. And so how it happens on the back end, you basically receive a questionnaire from the patient saying, I have these symptoms. And then if the person knows what to say, they kind of fulfill your pre-existing criteria for the diagnosis. And so you're kind of giving away to the patient what they should say. And if you give the person infinite trials, eventually some people will be able to
get it. Are these just joke consultations? Like any, you know, if you want it, you'll get it basically.
Yeah, but I mean, the defense is that what if you go to the doctor and say the exact same things? Like if you know what to say, the doctor eventually will give you the medication, right? Will prescribe the medication. But I think it's just making it easier. But the problem is that some people kind of learn with time how to answer the questions. And then they go through the ID check and then they receive the medication. So it makes sense for things like, you know, controlled medications to have more restrictions on them.
Yeah, I mean, Cerebral probably, I mean, I don't know anything about the company from the inside, but from the outside, like if you think about what startup founders are trying to do, they're trying to create retentive user experiences, right? So the classic like journey from inception to product market fit is one of, you know, initially trying to get people through the door to use your product and then looking for signs that the product is retentive, i.e. people start using it and then they keep using it. And then you can build growth off the back of that through referral, word of mouth, ads, whatever it may be. Cerebral hacked retention by literally addicting people to pills. So Adderall is an amphetamine, just like cocaine and other drugs of the same class. They act on neurotransmission pathways in the brain. They increase sensations of pleasure, of energy, and have really important effects in people with ADHD. They can help them
to focus.
It's like
the Limitless pill, right? On the Bradley Cooper film.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not, you know, Adderall has its role in ADHD management. I'm not saying that it's, you know, not chucking the baby out with the bathwater here. But as a startup, it's like, can you imagine looking at your retention metrics on like, you know, selling a product which is literally addictive in like people's brains, like it's actually changing the way their brains function. So the company soared to like a $5 billion valuation. It raised like $300 million in its last round. It was the darling of this like Gen 2, as Adam put it, like vertical telehealth archetype of company where, Generation 1, which my company played a small role in, was like relatively undifferentiated primary care. You know, these were the hugely funded, we're talking like billions of dollars raised, Cree, Babylon, Push Doctor. There were companies in the US that launched 10 to 15 years earlier than those, in fact. And then the generation two are all of these like vertically integrated, like picking a specific disease pathway, patient population. In this group, this was like a darling of that category. And it's not surprising, actually, when you think about the way that, that this whole thing works. But inevitably, it has been abused. And this is also happening in the context of the opioid epidemic in the United States of patients. You know, I think actually the net life expectancy of Americans has actually decreased, even if you remove the COVID figures recently. So this opioid epidemic and this general backdrop of like addictive and harmful medications being overprescribed is the context in which this is happening. So yeah, my view on this one is that I think that there should be a middle ground where a prescription can be given in a safer, more transparent or regulated or auditable fashion and more appropriately prescribed without needing to actually be in person, because there are still, unfortunately, issues around access of care in the United States. You know, such a big, geographically big country. And I think one of the implications here is that you actually have to go and see a clinician face-to-face to get your first prescription.
What's the point of the DEA saying that, look, you need to do an in-person consultation? Because for a lot of these drugs...
The point is that if you go to a physician and the physician asks you, you know, what are your symptoms? It's different than when you get a questionnaire that says, do you have any of these symptoms? And you're like, yes, yes, yes. And it's some of the questionnaires on these websites are kind of training you to say the right answer. They're giving you they're pre-filling the answers for you. They're just asking you, you know, to tick the boxes, and then it's just kind of training you to gain the system. Mm-hmm. And once you've seen a few of these questionnaires, you kind of know how to get what you want out of them.
And the reason people are going to these online pharmacies, one of the major reasons is speed of access. So if you want to book in to see a physician face-to-face, you know, in probably the waiting lists across, of course, they'll be highly variable, but there'll be like a few weeks at a minimum in most places. So getting access to an online physician...
Yeah, for ADHD, the UK wait list right now is around 3 to 7 years to get an assessment, the initial assessment.
Yeah, okay. It's crazy. So if you can go online and you can be seen by somebody within a day, which is what a lot of these services are promising, then that's, you know, transformational for these patients. By making it face-to-face, I think what you're doing is you're breaking the link in most cases between a startup actually being able to have a physician in every city to see that person. And then you're removing, therefore, some of the like tilting of the prescribing behaviors, which is some of the accusation that was made against Cerebral that, you know, physicians were basically being encouraged or gamified or incentivized or audited to increase their diagnoses and therefore their prescriptions because, you know, it aligns with the business model. I'm not saying that happened. I haven't seen any evidence that it has happened, but the accusation has been leveled and the company has denied it. Who knows what actually happened? If you make somebody see a local physician, it's going to be somebody who's probably seeing a wider range of clinical presentations in the course of their day. They're doing more of a fundamental assessment. It's probably less like a production line for prescriptions of these types of medications. It's going to probably be a more general service. So you're going to get a more holistic workup. There was actually an article in the BBC about the UK context. I don't want to make this just about the UK. Just in the last week or two, where somebody went online to like a reporter to 4 or 5 different websites, presented the same clinical vignette of symptoms and like timed how long it took to get a prescription. And they were being diagnosed by non-physicians on a regular basis in these services because the physicians are a bottleneck, or maybe the physicians have a different standard of practice, but they were being diagnosed by a variety of different clinical practitioners for prescriptions, and they're paying £500-£750 a pop.
Yeah, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I'm a doctor who works in psychiatry. And I know that with private diagnoses of certain conditions like ADHD, I know that NHS, so socialized healthcare system, they often don't respect that diagnosis. They say, no, we're going to do our own assessment and diagnosis because we know that these private clinics are incentivized basically to dish these out. So that's another kind of messed up incentive, you could say.
And another difference between the UK and the US is in the US, it's super easy to target certain keywords using Google Ads. So if someone is searching for Adderall, you're going to find certain services that will cater towards you getting an ADHD diagnosis and then getting your medication. Whereas in the UK, it's very difficult to target these prescription medication words.
Why?
Just because of the difference in laws. So the on Google, you need a GPHC number in order to be able to advertise any prescription medication, which is like you need to be a registered pharmacy, basically.
Yeah.
So not any startup can just like advertise and target these keywords.
Can you talk a little bit to the cost implications? So say you have one scenario formally where you just do the whole consultation online with a doctor who's based in any geography and mm-hmm. they prescribe it all online, versus in the future when you have to do the in-person consultation, does that really mess with the economics of the business?
I don't think fundamentally it will mess with it that much, because a lot of you need to see a physician once. Once you get the diagnosis, then you have the patient for life, and most of the money is made in the repeat prescriptions.
Version generation one telemedicine, which was your undifferentiated, typically primary care consult, that was a pay-as-you-go, and there was no recurring revenue model aside from if you paid a subscription for the service. So if you paid the monthly retainer to be like a Babylon customer or whatever, then had access to the physicians, or you paid as you went for a consult. These companies, what they have done now is they've created a recurring revenue model on the physical product, which is, I don't know exactly what the margins are, but I think that there will be close to software margins. And as long as you can establish that relationship, as Adam says, and you can have that ongoing fulfillment and delivery of the drug, then you can have that recurring revenue model into the future. So the economics kind of still work in the long run. You just have probably a bottleneck and a point of friction on the onboarding. This is where it's like deliberate to stop the willy-nilly onboarding of patients with a diagnosis who maybe don't deserve one. Because what you'll have to do is probably strike kind of commercial relationships with groups of physicians or networks of clinics which have good geographical footprint coverage, so that they can basically assess your patient and then do that part of the service for you. And then that will obviously dent their margin or some way, because they're outsourcing, and then the patient comes back into the service. And as long as you can retain them in the long run, then it should still be okay. But I think you'll have a blunting of the uptake.
Is this going to make things worse now, though? Because now you have a large upfront cost where you've done an in-person evaluation. And you're from what you've said, your main source of income is actually coming from the recurring fee. So now, is it not a situation where you're almost more incentivized to give the positive diagnosis and bring them on as a customer? Whereas before, you're doing a quick telemedicine consultation, much cheaper, much lower upfront cost.
I suspect they'll pass the cost on to the patient.
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, how would you solve this problem? Like, let's say, Adam, this is your business. Not that you would sell... You just stick to selling addictive Instagram posts instead of actual medications. but what would you actually do? How would you solve this?
I mean, there are going to probably be, as you said, like sticks and shovels, did you call them?
Picks and shovels.
Picks and shovels.
We're not having a riot, Adam. We're just like giving people healthcare.
So, yeah. I mean, there are picks and shovel solutions to these issues. In order to be like a viable business like this across the US, you need to be licensed in all 50 states. You need like a huge infrastructure. So it's just easier to plug into these already existing networks that already have the regulatory framework. And they just take on all the burden. They take on all the liability. So I don't think anything will change. What will change for startups is the price. But as I said, I think they'll just put it on the patient. And especially for these types of medications, the kind of demand is so high that I think there's a lot of leeway when it comes to price.
Mm-hmm. Imran, anything you'd do differently if you were in the proverbial war room and you got this date of November 2024, sorry, where these changes are going to take place potentially?
I mean, it's an existential threat to your business, but I think the first and foremost thing would be to make sure that you don't blunt the uptake curve. That would be like my North Star, is like making sure that I can create pathways into in-person diagnoses without slowing down uptake, because if you're running a company like this, if you have developed a reputation for being like difficult to onboard or having a bad experience or having lots of delays in medication access and so on, then that's going to not be good for your patients, provided they're getting appropriate prescriptions, but it's also going to knock your reputation. So I think that would be, that's kind of stating the obvious, but.
I mean, ultimately it might be actually a good thing for certain startups. It's an opportunity because there's not that much differentiation in this category. So if you're able to overcome this hurdle and create a pathway that is seamless and works, then that's actually an opportunity.
All right, guys. Shall we move on then to the new Nature paper? So this came out on the 7th of June, 2023, called Health System Scale Language Models Are All-Purpose Prediction Engines. This is by Zhang et al. Imran, tell us about this paper, but firstly, why it's interesting and why we should care.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, a team from the US, East Coast, New York region, they took patient notes from 3 to 400,000 patients. They were like several million patient notes. And they used a large language model, which actually wasn't like that large. I mean, it was large, but not like, I think it was less than 1 billion parameters, which is not like the largest out there by any means. And then they basically threw all these notes at it and they trained it. And then they kind of fine-tuned it a little bit to answer some specific questions, 5 specific questions. I won't go through all of them, but things like predicting the likelihood that a patient will be readmitted to hospital in 30 days. That's really important because it's something that hospitals like to reduce as a measure of quality is readmissions. How likely a patient is to die in hospital, that's important. How long a patient is likely to stay in hospital, whether the patient is likely to have their insurance denied, right? Which is interesting. I wonder what they're using that one for. We can talk about that more later. And they basically found that like a large language model that was trained on this hospital system's notes performed much better than physicians at predicting these metrics, but also much better than what you might call traditional machine learning approaches. So large language models, just as a reminder, like basically what they're doing is they're reading like text as an input, and they're learning the patterns in language itself without any intrinsic understanding of the meaning of the words, right? So they'll see sentences and they won't know that a cup is like a thing made of porcelain necessarily, only by association of that word with other words will they infer things like that. So it's basically just patterns in words. And some people have called them like, you know, stochastic parrots, you know, like parrots will parrot language, but they don't actually understand always the nuance or what the meaning is there. Despite that, this approach produced much better results than traditional machine learning models and like expert physicians. Traditional models here include things like rule-based systems. So we talked about Babylon in the last pod. The early Babylon Health like diagnostic engine was a rules-based engine where, you know, it's like if just in on the basis of certain responses would predict the outcome. So it's kind of a simplistic system. But then there are other machine learning approaches like random forest, decision trees, and even more simple statistical techniques. And this is outperforming all of those. Now, those traditional techniques, in order to build those machine learning models, the non-LLM machine learning models, you need really structured data, right? So I in 2016, 2017, I was involved in a research study in a commercial setting, which looked at 100 million patients' medical records in the United States and tried to build a model to understand the behavior of multiple sclerosis patients. And there was literally a team of 30 to 40 people that spent like 8 months before any analysis was done, just engineering features in the data, just looking at the data, cleaning it, like deciding what an MS relapse was in the data, labeling it as such, cleaning up like all kinds of random noise that was in the data. 80 to 90% of the effort was spent on that. And then the analysis piece, like, you know, the striker would like swoops in at the end of a long play in a football game and just like pops the ball in the goal. It was like that with the data scientists. Like they would just do the analysis at the very end of this process.
It's like crude oil, right? Like it's extremely valuable, but you need to clean it up first.
Exactly, exactly. And it's such a big, heavy lift. This is not doing any of that, right? So this is unstructured clinical notes.
Dirty
so it's really important to understand the distinction there that's like foundational in this whole paper and why it's so important.
So basically what LLMs are doing, correct me if I'm wrong, it just increases the number of parameters that it's
Adam, that was very, very humble. I've never heard you hedge something with correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm becoming nicer because I'm on antibiotics.
Yeah, no, sorry, I interrupted. What were you saying?
No, what was your question?
I'm saying, basically,
I was so stunned by correct me if I'm wrong. I stopped listening.
Usually it's like overconfidence.
They're just increasing the number of parameters that are included in the analysis, right? Like that's the
The model is fundamentally different. Like it's not using like all this cleaned, structured, labeled, feature-enriched data. It's using just clinical notes. It's just using clinical notes.
So why is it better than traditional methods of analysis? It's because the parameters that it's including in the analysis are just bigger, right? And more complex.
I think it's
because it's reasoning
through language. That's my understanding, right? So the difference between an LLM and these other approaches is like the reasoning is happening through language prediction. It's a different paradigm. But just to kind of get back to the point, like the kind of bottom line here is that the results on the predictive power, they're reported here as area under the curve, which is like a numerical representation of the discriminatory power of a prediction. Yeah. So like a 0.5 would be like tossing a coin. It's like, you know, no better than random guessing. But one would be like perfect discriminatory power. So this is scoring between like 0.7 and 0.9 on these clinical and operational predictions around length of stay, around readmission, around inpatient mortality, and so on. So objectively, 0.7 to 0.9 is like pretty good. It's definitely not just random guessing. And it's like when you're getting up to 0.9, 0.95, 0.94, as some of them were, that's actually very, very predictive. It's a very strong prediction. So objectively, that's very strong.
Was there any explainability in this model that they used? Because I guess the key point is, okay, it makes all of these observations, like, you know, this group of patients are more likely to be readmitted. The next question is, what do you do about it?
The short answer is no, as far as I understand. But what you can do is you can do something called, you can create perturbations in the input data, which basically means like, if you have like notes going in and you're reading, the model is like processing the notes and giving you a prediction, you can tweak words. So then you can look at the impact of any specific input word, syllable, space, grammar, etc., on the output result. So you can do things like that. So you can begin to sort of start to infer like what's driving the output prediction. But they haven't reported much on that here. And LLMs in general are like a bit of a black box. They're not particularly explainable, as I understand it. Like, I'm not an expert, but they're not like, you know, they're not explainable in the same way that logistic regression is, or a
The problem with that is if we use similar techniques for clinical decisions, and that will lead to kind of clinical decisions being made by these black box LLMs that are not really like understandable 100%. By humans.
Yeah, 100%. And so, what happens if you get that wrong?
Yeah,
and I don't know.
Where's the liability? And It's weird territory.
Yeah, it is weird. It is weird. Like, can you imagine, like, especially like, what are these insurance denials? You know,
the dystopian view of that is that you walk into the hospital and a machine that can't even explain how it's made its decision decides that your insurance is going to deny you. You're not receiving care, right? That's the dystopian model, and they can't even tell you why.
Yeah, yeah, or influence your care decisions. But I think this is the direction of travel, because, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but like, there probably are people that are working to develop tools to increase explainability. I'm sure that's like a research agenda. I don't know much about it. But there's already so much about physicians' behavior that's not explainable. You know, is you like how many of your colleagues, I'm sure they're very esteemed, but like how many of them are practicing evidence-based medicine to a T?
Yeah, that's true. But at the end of the day, like liability, the laws are very specific in the fact that like every decision needs to come from someone, and that person is liable for that decision. When it comes from an algorithm, that's where things become murky.
Yeah. The other thing here, there wasn't a big deal made of bias in this research study, but as we know, bias is a huge deal generally in AI systems and also in electronic medical record trained systems, which in the past have been shown to be discriminatory in their predictive or decision support recommendations for certain patient groups. This paper reported that their model performed worst in Black patients, in the elderly, like very elderly, like 80 to 90, and it could be maybe because their health is more volatile and less predictable anyway, and in internal medicine. And when I was thinking about where this type of thing would be most useful, I imagine it would be like the kind of polypharmacy, multi-morbid, elderly, frail patient segment that makes up the greatest, overrepresented in inpatients. So, and also at high risk of readmission and whatnot. So the model actually performs least well in those groups, which is interesting because I'm glad that they actually reported that because it is relevant from a bias point of view. But it goes to show that like just developing this type of technology is not the end game. It's like safely implementing it, monitoring it, understanding how it's treating different patients who are similar in their characteristics other than race or economic status or what have you. And making sure that once you know they're implemented, that you're doing that safely and ethically, and developing the model on that dimension as well.
One of the really interesting thought experiments I've been thinking around is just treating human physicians and calling them, say, human OS, the human operating system, and just thinking how poor that model could be. In the sense that, think about how much, as physicians, we have, how much silent evidence there is. So how many times have you been working in the ED and send a patient home, and you really don't know if they got better or got worse. It's unlikely you'll have that kind of feedback loop come back to you. And Scott Alexander writes about this, who has a really good blog, but he talks about how that breeds overconfidence in physicians. You know, the classic stat is that 90% of physicians think they're above average, which obviously can't be true. But it is that you don't see your mistakes. It's very unlikely that that feedback loop came back. So I do find these algorithmic approaches to decision-making, of course, they have problems with bias and other things and confabulation, but I think overall it's very, very interesting if we think of human OS and LLMs as two separate entities.
Yeah, I can buy that. And I think just also with this, just generally, like, you know, there's been a lot of talk about artificial intelligence and so on recently, but I think what I found so compelling about this is like it's a real example. It's in a real hospital system. It's a model that was integrated into actual EMR and like, you know, clinical workflows, trained on local patients with some like validation. So if anyone was like speculating about like when this thing is going to hit, you know, we talked even just like a few podcasts ago about like, where is clinical decision support or prediction or these things, where are they going to come into the doctor's workflow from? You know, we talked about like, is it going to come from the EMR? Is it going to come from a startup? Is it going to come from somewhere else? So this is it. Like, it's landed, it's here. And it's being used in a real hospital, I think.
Is there a product here? Like, is there an opportunity here for people to move into?
Well, there is an implication for, I think, people building products here. Because I've spoken to a few people in the last few months who are like, you know, we want to build like an integration into Epic or Cerner and like build this thing, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, all you need is, okay, these guys are super smart and talented, but you need like a hospital, which is willing. And you need some like, you know, academic researchers across a few different disciplines. And probably in 6 to 12 months, you can deploy something like this.
Okay, so let's do some audience feedback. So we got some nice feedback from Checo Ortiz, who said, I absolutely love your podcast. Would it be possible to add subtitles on your videos? Greetings from Colombia. Do any of you speak Spanish?
Did GCSE Spanish. I was quite good 20 years ago.
Okay. There's an AI tool
for that.
But no, that was really nice feedback. And on the point of subtitles, that's a good idea. If you go on YouTube, Ortiz, you can do closed captions, and I believe they translate. But we don't have official subtitles yet, but appreciate the kind message. The other bit of feedback I wanted to quickly touch on was from our Babylon episode. So our last episode was the rise and demise of Babylon Health, which is always a bit of a funny topic because you're essentially being a bit of a hater. You're being a bit negative. You're not being like a positive sum player in the ecosystem. So I don't like doing them, but I think it is an interesting and important topic to cover. But we got a ton of feedback. I kind of shared it with you guys. But I mean, me and Imran, I think we got some various messages from quite senior people who worked at Babylon Health, essentially saying, really enjoyed it, agree with most of your points, and appreciate you being respectful and not just hating and shitting on Babylon. I think, Adam, you were actually quite positive about Babylon, but I think I was a bit provocative with my questioning.
It's because Adam's trying to get a job at Babylon.
That is the tension, though, isn't it?
I just, you know, I respect people who tackle hard problems and not all of them work out.
Adam's from Babylon, that's why.
I do wonder, though, the fact that we got so much positive feedback on it, does that mean that we were too soft and too nice? Would it have been better? I did get one bit of negative feedback, which essentially said that you guys went really soft on a company that was doing clinically dangerous stuff, your doctors. You should have talked about that more. It's not just an entrepreneur who had a shot at something and failed. This was actually some dangerous decision-making going on. So that was a bit of negative feedback, which is fair enough.
Okay, fair enough.
But I think we did a good job, but I think we were probably a bit soft. And that does come into our own incentives by doing this, that we are in somewhere in the ecosystem and we have to protect our own various affiliations and things. So I guess we can't be too blasé. But I think it was a good episode. It was interesting. I got really good feedback from it.
Yeah, similarly, like one of the former C-suite of the company said...
I have a suggestion. I think we should do guests with like all three of us as a panel. So let's... if anyone is interested, if anyone's still listening, comment in the... give us a comment about if you think that's a good idea.
Wait, Imran, say your C-suite thing and then, yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, just to echo what you're saying, a couple of people who are quite senior in Babylon over the years, including recent years, said similar things. They said they thought it was a balanced and good discussion. I also empathize with the sense that, you know, I think patient safety is obviously something that we all feel very like sensitive and attentive to. I've never seen any analysis of like the actual impact. I've seen a lot of like hypothetical, oh, I went on Babylon and, was my mom's persona with chest pain and I got told to, you know, something. But I would love to see if there, maybe in the fullness of time, there may be some report on this or some way to publish this data.
True. So Adam, on your point about guests, the thing I think about though is that, so I watch the All In podcast a lot, and when they have a guest on, it's what they're recording for like almost 2 hours. And even then how do you think a three-person interview would work? Do you think it has to be around like a discussion topic rather than like an interview?
Yeah, more of a discussion topic, but it just jazzes things up a bit and brings in someone who with a different perspective.
Okay, fair enough. I think people like us. They like you, Adam, and Imran as well. But yeah, I think we can try it.
Very kind. Very kind. It's good fun. Okay. Stops me from like spiraling into like a lonely dad midlife crisis situation. So, although we have missed like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Did you get any messages from people saying?
Let's try and be on it. I know it's like mostly my fault. I'm usually the one who postpones. So sorry about that.
No, you don't postpone. You just don't turn up. That's different. Postponing would be fine. It's when you don't turn up. I get like iron a shirt, turn up, get my light ready, get my microphone out.
It's not the same without you. We tried. It's not the same.
Oh, thanks.
Stop falling into trapdoors in museums in Beirut.
Nice. All right, guys, we'll do this again soon. Right. Thank you.
All the best. Thanks, man.